SB, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the book release for Radical Mycology, a book on DIY mushroom cultivation, pollution cleanup, and more. The book release event will take place February 6th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. with author and Portland native Peter McCoy speaking at Tabor Space in Portland. McCoy will give two different presentations on the book's topics. There will also be a performance piece, projection art, and more. Again, that's the Radical Mycology book release, Saturday, February 6th, from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is the evening news, followed by Labor Radio, and then Prison Pipeline at 6:30, and Hard Knock Radio at 7. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting Cleaning Up the Willamette, the Portland Harbor Superfund site. This civic education program takes place Tuesday, February 9th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More information can be found online at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the presidential race kicks off for real tonight as Iowans gather for their state caucuses.
Several hundred members of Portland State University's new Graduate Employees Union gathered on campus today to request neutrality from the university administration.
And the World Health Organization has declared the Zika virus to be a public health emergency of international concern.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 1st, 2016. I'm Joanna Peterson.
And I'm Ken Jones. Ammon Bundy is expected to argue again for bail today. The leader of the group of armed militants who took over the federal building in eastern Oregon was arrested last week, but denied bail on charges he's allegedly a flight risk. As our broadcast begins tonight, four armed people remain in the Maller Wildlife Refuge, but their electricity and internet connections have been turned off. Meanwhile, nine of the former occupiers of the Maller Wildlife Refuge facility remain in the county jail, charged with conspiracy to impede officers through the use of force, intimidation, or threats. One has been released with an ankle monitoring device and is expected to return to Utah. However, a federal magistrate judge is refusing bail for Bundy, finding him to be, quote, a danger to the community. Also finding that he repeatedly disregarded the orders of federal agents to leave the wildlife building where he and other armed men and women threatened to overthrow the government. Bundy's attorneys are expected to argue today that the magistrate judge did not prove her case.
A Gresham Sam Barlow School Board Advisory Committee has proposed a $299 million bond measure be placed on this year's November ballot. The bond would be the largest ever in the Gresham area, and it would cost $742 per year for a home valued at $250,000. In 2013, a $210 million bond measure was defeated in Gresham by 16 percentage points. The 33-member committee visited all 18 schools in the district, met with community organizations, and commissioned two polls. The bond money would be used to build two new schools, upgrade and expand classroom space in existing buildings, and improve heating and energy systems in all buildings.
The Brentwood-Darlington Neighborhood Association hosts a meeting this Thursday night on the homeless camp at 82nd Avenue near the Springwater Trail. The association sent out a bulletin this week calling on anyone in the city to attend the discussion about a rise in crime in the area as well as unsafe conditions for the campers. Organizers are calling on the city to come up with a plan to reduce crime, protect the environment, and begin offering meaningful services to houseless campers. In recent weeks, two campers were arrested for criminal acts, and another has suffered frostbite, the Neighborhood Association said. The meeting's at 7 p.m. Thursday, February 4th, at the Brentwood-Darlington Community Center.
Several hundred members of Portland State University's new Graduate Employees Union gathered on campus today to officially announce the creation of the union and request neutrality from the university's administration. The new union is comprised of over 800 graduate employees who organized in support of fair wages, affordable health care, and reasonable workloads. The members delivered their request for neutrality to University President Wim Vivel. The request also calls for the administration to request the new union's right to organize. For more information, KBOO's Jamie Partridge was there on the PSU campus and talked with union members Drew Mahidi and Jane Carr.
Jamie Partridge, KBOO News. We're out here at the University Plaza at Portland State University in front of the Academic and Student Recreation Center. And there's a big banner that says Graduate Employees Union. And there's close to 100 folks milling around that all have buttons on that say, I am, or we are, GEU. And I'm talking with
Drew Mahidi.
Drew Mahidi, tell us what GEU is.
So the GEU is our Graduate Employees Union, and we're out here to represent approximately 800 graduate employees who teach, do research, and support, do administrative support for the university.
Portland State University, this is something new.
It is, yeah. It's a new thing for us, for the university and for the community.
And this is your coming out event.
It is, yes. This is our public coming out right now.
So what do you plan to do today?
So today we plan to obviously go public, but also let the administration know that we are requesting neutrality and that they respect our legal right to organize.
And by neutrality, you mean?
Neutrality in terms of just respecting our right to organize and not interfere in any way that would, not be neutral, essentially.
So they not go anti-union,
go anti-union in their campaign or in their methods.
So graduate employees have organized around the country at universities. There's a graduate employees union at University of Oregon.
At U of O and OSU both have graduate employees unions.
And they've been around for a few years now.
They've been around for decades, yeah.
So what are the issues? What is it that caused graduate employees to decide to come together and form a union here now?
So some of the main issues are we feel we deserve fair wages, affordable health care, and reasonable workloads. And that's really what it comes down to. And so that's why we're out here today organizing.
By fair wages, are you part of the fight for 15 or?
No, we're not. It's just in terms of, being a TA or an RA, not the wider $15 an hour.
TA or RA, what does that mean?
So a TA is a teaching assistant, and an RA or GRA is a graduate research assistant.
And there's been some controversy across the country, in fact, lawsuits and all kinds of complaints before the labor board about whether or not graduate students are employees and whether or not they have the right to be classified as employees. What do you expect to happen here?
We just expect that the university recognize our right to our legal right to organize, and that's why we're out here today, and we're hoping to get that done.
And what are the working condition issues that you're concerned about?
For a lot of students, having a reasonable workload is definitely a key one. For a lot of us, we work more hours, obviously, than we're paid for. And so that's very critical for us. And the work we do for the university is vital.
And healthcare, what's going on there?
So healthcare, a lot of students can't afford the ever-rising cost of healthcare. And a lot of international students are required to buy the university health insurance. There are exceptions, but for the most part, that's kind of the case. And it's extremely expensive, especially when a lot of our stipend and just pay in general goes back to the university.
Fair wages, health insurance, working conditions. You're hoping to go to, who are you hoping to meet with today?
We're hoping to meet with Vim Vivelle and the administration.
And Vim Vivelle is?
He is the president of the university and the administration, and to provide them with our neutrality agreement. Yeah, and show some solidarity for all the graduate workers.
Thank you.
Drew Mahidi.
So we're out here on the plaza. The crowd is growing. We're into the hundreds now. And I'm talking with
Jane Carr.
Jane Carr, who's got one of these We Are GEU, Graduate Employees Union. And Jane, why are you getting involved with this effort?
Well, as a graduate student union, we've come to realize that many of us are very much undercompensated, and much of our salary is going to pay for health insurance that we had no role in selecting, and to student fees. For me personally, I teach a course in civic leadership here at PSU. I'm the full instructor, which means I plan the syllabus, run classes, do all the grading independently, which is something I love and very dedicated to. And I have been doing this my fourth year, having done that work. And doing that work and being paid only a few hundred dollars a month in take home, and not having as much of an opportunity to feel valued or part of the university, is something that has been able to change through being involved in the union. And I started to realize that my work really is important, and that's why I personally have chosen to be part of this organizing effort, reaching out to my colleagues, being part of our effort, so that no other graduate employees have to feel that sense that their work isn't valuable just because we're not paid very well.
What do you think about what's happening here today?
I'm really excited to see everyone out. It feels like a really positive energy here. It's great to see everyone actually in the Urban Plaza itself. We're really looking forward to going to President Vivelle's office to ask him to be neutral as we unionize.
And what would you like members of the community, people who are supportive of your efforts, to do, or how can they learn more about what you're up to?
We've been working hard to develop our website, which is pdxgeu.org, and that's also where you can find us on Twitter and Facebook with pdxgeu.
Thank you, Jane. Jamie Partridge, KBOO News.
The nation's first vote to determine the country's next president will occur tonight in Iowa. As both the Republican and Democratic parties hold caucuses to determine Iowa's choices for president. The most recent Iowa poll put Donald Trump in the lead on the Republican side with 28% of likely caucus goers, just ahead of Ted Cruz with 23%. The poll puts Marco Rubio in third place with 15%, then Ben Carson at 10%, followed by all the rest with 5% or less. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton holds a narrow lead over Bernie Sanders, 45% to 42%, while Martin O'Malley trails with just 3%. To find out more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Elaine Mattingly, an Iowa Democrat volunteering at tonight's precinct caucus.
I'm a volunteer. This is my first time being a precinct captain for a campaign inside the precinct. So the precinct will have somebody like me for the O'Malley campaign and somebody like me for the Hillary campaign. And then there's some volunteers who volunteer on behalf of the Democratic Party to oversee the whole thing and make sure that they're gathering the results and collaborating with those of us from the three campaigns, getting us all on the same page. And so prior to going in this evening, there's going to be, it's already been determined that based on, I believe it's population, that our precinct will have, I don't know how many exactly delegates we're going to be able to send on from our precinct, but I know it's more than four. It's four or more. So I'm actually heading to the campaign office now to get some additional information. But what I do know is that once we get into the precinct caucus room, which in our case is an elementary school, we will, first of all, folks have to get there by prior to 7 o'clock, and then the doors will close. And then there'll be a time, you know, people will be arriving, and they'll be some may register to vote. And if they need to, there'll be people there taking registration. And there's been people who change their affiliation from Republican to Democrat just for the purpose of being involved in the caucus, which is interesting. You can go back and forth with registering to vote, you know, throughout this process, throughout the season here. So if I wanted to, I could change my affiliation in order to caucus at the Republican caucus. Yeah. So we will then be, we arrive, we take a count of how many people are eligible to participate, take a head count after that. All of us agree on what that head count is. And then based on that head count, there will be a percentage that we apply to that count that determines how many delegates it will take to be viable, for a candidate to be viable, meaning that they have earned a delegate to send on to the county convention. So, you know, there's for example, our campaign, the Bernie campaign, aspires to meet a certain amount of delegates based on their strategy and projection. And I'm sure the other campaigns have the same. I kind of view this whole thing as kind of akin to like high stakes fantasy sports or something. it smacks of all this strategy and teams and alignments and calculations and it's really kind of a blast. And it's also really not a vote as much as it is. It's almost more of a straw poll. So what our purpose tonight is to assign delegates for the campaign to get as many delegates as possible committed to be a delegate for our candidate at the county convention level. And then after that, once at the convention, delegates will be aligning themselves again and get sent on up to a district and then on up to the national, you know, as part of the whole electoral college process. So that's kind of what I know at this point.
You mentioned qualified to participate. Now, aside from being a person who resides within that specific precinct and you declared a registration within the correct party, what else? Is there anything else or is that it?
Yeah, you have to turn 18 by the November election. That's one requirement. So in order to register, in order to participate, that's the deal there. And you also have to register to vote. So there's going to be some folks who are registering to vote and not even fully 18 yet. So that's kind of exciting.
You remind me, the big question, what do you think, what's turnout going to be like? I presume you've been doing some phone calling, trying to get people out.
I think it's just going to be, there's going to be a lot of people there. I think there's going to be large turnout, and I think it will likely in Jasper County. I kind of expect it to mirror the latest, you know, most credible polling that they're posting out there. It feels like a neck and neck race to me because there's been incredible momentum in both the Hillary and the Bernie campaign, just constant presence by, you know, celebrities and shipped in volunteers from everywhere, and the candidates themselves coming back repeatedly, even to just little Newton, Iowa. You know, Bernie's been here like 3 times, and Hillary's been here several times as well, and recently as well.
What do you hear happening on the other side?
Well, it seems real. You know, all the energy is clearly behind Trump, Cruz, and Rubio, I would say that Rubio probably has more support than the media might in Iowa, than the media might indicate nationally. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Iowa went for Santorum, last time. And so on the GOP side, it's a little harder for me to anticipate.
I've been speaking with Elaine Mattingly. She is a Democrat, an activist living in Jasper County, Iowa. She'll be at the caucus tonight in Newton. Elaine, thank you so much.
Thanks, Doug. Bye-bye.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
The Iowa caucuses started at 5 p.m. Pacific time, so results won't be available until later tonight, possibly as early as 7 p.m. Pacific time. New Hampshire's primary takes place next week.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Lana Jack of Celilo Falls, who will speak on our family's struggle for federal recognition of their tribal treaty rights. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, then Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, 20% chance of showers after 10 p.m., patchy fog later. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a low around 36. Tomorrow, patchy fog before 10 a.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a high near 45. Today in history, in 1960, four African-American college students began a sit-in protest at Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, where they'd been refused service. In 1965, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested along with about 300 others when they attempted to march on the Dallas County Courthouse in Selma, Alabama, to protest voter registration procedures. And in 2003, the Space Shuttle Columbia disintegrated on reentry, killing all 7 crew members aboard. The quote of the day is from Herman Melville. He said, "We cannot live only for ourselves. 1,000 fibers connect us with our fellow men."
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When I crossed paths with a Democratic campaign consultant in Austin last March, I suggested he come to the local IBEW hall to hear Bernie, adding that the Vermont senator was pondering a run for the presidency. "You gotta be kidding me," he snorted. "Bernie Sanders? Let me tell you, his chances are slim and none, and Slim don't live in Bernie's precinct. First of all, no one south of Greenwich Village ever heard of him. Second, who's going to vote for some old senator from a tiny state of Birkenstock wares damn near in Canada?" So he was a no-show. But we didn't have room for him anyway. The hall would seat 200, but nearly 500 Texans showed up that night to hear the undiluted populist message of this senator, quote, no one ever heard of. Austin was one of the stops on a cross-country trip that Bernie was taking to assess whether an unabashedly progressive, movement-building presidential campaign could rally any substantial support. If he ran, he intended to go right at the moneyed elites who thoroughly corrupted our politics and rigged our economy to squeeze the life out of the middle class. But would anyone follow? He wasn't sure, and even if it might work, he assumed it would be a slow build. I was to introduce him at the Austin event, and as we worked our way from the parking lot, waving to the overflow group gathered outside, shaking hands with people standing in the hallway and stairwell, then squeezing through the jam-packed crowd in the auditorium, I said to him, "Something is happening here." He nodded and said in an astonished whisper, "Something is happening." This is Jim Hightower saying, that surprisingly big night in Austin was a precursor to what would soon become the Sanders sensation. A people-powered movement that has already shattered the Democratic establishment's holy myth that corporate centrism and super PAC money are the only means to victory. By going straight to the people, Bernie is showing another way.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court
declined to consider reviving what would have been the most restrictive abortion law in the country, North Dakota's so-called fetal heartbeat law. The law would have banned abortion so early in gestation that many women would not even know that they were pregnant yet. But that didn't stop Florida lawmakers from advancing an even stricter measure this week. As FSRN's Sean Kinane reports, it's just one of several abortion-related bills state legislators are considering, including measures which look a lot like a Texas law currently on the Supreme Court's docket.
The most far-reaching bill before Florida's Republican-dominated state legislature would ban almost all abortions. It's sponsored by Republican Representative Charles Van Zandt and passed the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee this week on a vote of 8-3.
The bill recognizes that both the mother and the baby are citizens of Florida. Both their inalienable right, both their God-given right to each have their lives is and has been a recognized fundamental right as early as the Declaration of Independence.
It's not the first time Van Zandt has brought forth an anti-abortion bill that's of questionable legal standing. Pro-choice groups are pushing back. Laura Goodhue is executive director of the Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood Affiliates.
And it's really clear just from the way that the bill is written that it is a challenge to the constitutionality of safe and legal abortion. And so, I do believe it's grandstanding. I think it's unfortunate that the legislators are spending time on this because it's political interference at its worst.
And that grandstanding could be expensive for Florida. If this bill becomes law, it will almost certainly be challenged, perhaps all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided this week not to hear a challenge by North Dakota to revive its abortion law that had been struck down because it outlawed abortions after a heartbeat was detected. But Florida's bill goes even further, the moment of conception. In its 1992 Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutional right to have an abortion. Adam Levine is an adjunct professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. He also used to be an OBGYN doctor.
If they're just doing it for politics to show their constituents that they're working hard to eliminate abortion and they're going to drop it, okay, it's a small win for everyone's time and effort. But if they're doing this specifically to get a challenge up against Casey and Planned Parenthood, against Roe versus Wade, if that's what the plan is, if they want to entice the Supreme Court into a discussion, then that's going to require a lot of money. And I think it's disingenuous of these representatives and senators to pick this fight without putting in the budget how much money they're going to need to spend to do this fight.
43 years ago, Roe versus Wade determined that access to safe legal abortions was a constitutional right under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Van Zandt's bill to ban abortions outright is the most drastic of the bills in the Florida legislature designed to restrict access to abortion. But it's not the only one. One bill would mandate special licensing requirements for clinics that perform abortions. Another would require doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital. The provisions are very similar to a Texas law known as HB2, which is to be argued before the Supreme Court in March. The vice president of a Florida chapter of the National Organization for Women says plans to further regulate abortion clinics would disproportionately limit access for low-income women. Linda Darren is with Pinellas Now.
In this state, Medicaid does not cover abortions. So poor women that have children are covered under Medicaid, but they can't get an abortion paid for by Medicaid. So their only option is to go to abortion clinics, basically. And when we continue to put in rules there that make it harder, like Texas, Florida's trying to put in the rule that they just put in Texas on abortion clinics. Over half their clinics closed because they couldn't meet these requirements.
Another bill before the Florida legislature aims to prevent Planned Parenthood from receiving government funds for services covered by Medicaid. Federal and state-level attempts to defund Planned Parenthood intensified after a group known as the Center for Medical Progress released heavily edited sting videos targeting the organization. Two people associated with the Center for Medical Progress were indicted this week by a grand jury in Harris County, Texas, on charges related to the videos. Florida's many abortion-related bills still have committee stops to clear before they can be voted on by the full House or Senate. Sean Canan, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Florida.
A new study shows students punished for behavioral problems by being suspended or expelled instead of getting treatment are more likely to wind up in the criminal system. The study published this week in the journal Criminology says school punishment involves being labeled as a troublemaker, and that follows children throughout their school careers. Government statistics already show Black and Latino students are the most likely to be punished with suspension or expulsion. Experts say that dynamic leads to a higher dropout rate among these kids and a higher incarceration rate. Compared with their peers who are not expelled, students who miss classroom because of punishment have lower grade point averages, perform worse on tests, and score lower on state competency exams, according to the Criminology report. The study examined responses from more than 3,000 white, Black, and Latino males who participated in the National Longitudinal Study of Youth between 1988 and 2012.
Nobel Peace Prize watchers are speculating that Edward Snowden is among the nominees for the 2016 Nobel Peace Prize. Snowden is the former NSA contractor who leaked details of the U.S. government spy programs. Other nominees include peace negotiators in Colombia, Greek islanders helping Syrian refugees, negotiators for the Iran nuclear program, and more. Today is the deadline for nominations. The winner of the prize will be announced in October. Snowden began leaking classified intelligence documents in June 2013, revealing the extent of the NSA spying activities. Those activities included the massive collection of phone records of Americans and foreign nationals, as well as political leaders from around the world. In other countries, the leaks have led to new restrictions on intelligence gathering and advancement of social justice. The U.S. government has filed espionage charges against Snowden, who has been granted asylum in Russia. Should Snowden receive the award, he will receive $930,000.
In Myanmar today, Democratic leader Aung San Suu Kyi took her seat in parliament. An historic political change in the small country saw her National League for Democracy taking control for the first time. After a decades-long struggle to end military rule, the NLD party holds the majority seat and is expected to pass massive reform legislation. A party spokesperson said today that even though the military has a history of taking over, quote, when it feels threatened, the reformers are hopeful this time it will last. The military still retains 25% of all seats in parliament, which was a compromise in the constitution they helped draft. Also taking seats were representatives from ethnic parties from around the country.
Faced with a governmental debt default, Puerto Rico has proposed a new debt restructuring plan that would preclude any payments for at least 2 years and possibly no payments until 2026. Currently, Puerto Rico has more than $70 billion in debt, equal to almost 70% of the Commonwealth's annual GDP. The U.S. territory has been in the midst of an 11-year economic depression, leaving it unable to meet its debt payments. Current United States law, under which Puerto Rico is bound, does not allow Puerto Rico to claim bankruptcy nor default on their debt. But last year, the president of Puerto Rico announced that the country would be unable to meet its upcoming payment obligations. Several hedge funds sued the Puerto Rican government, demanding to be paid. U.S. courts upheld that opinion and ordered Puerto Rico to continue making payments, to which the Puerto Rican government stated that they would be unable to. The U.S. government has stated they will not bail out the U.S.-controlled territory. The Puerto Rican government has now proposed issuing super bonds to replace existing debt that is due. The super bonds would not require any payments for at least 2 years and would possibly provide for no payments for up to 10 years. The U.S. Congress is set to hold hearings on the debt restructuring proposal starting tomorrow.
A suicide bomber detonated a large bomb at Syria's holiest Shiite site, killing more than 60 people. The attack occurred just as opposition leaders in the Syrian government are set to begin UN-brokered peace talks in Geneva. The terrorist group Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack. In more Syrian news, the Kurdish army, known as the YPG, has been steadily advancing along the Syrian-Turkish border. The open border area, along which Daesh fighters and weapons flow freely, is now down to less than 60 miles, and the Kurdish army is advancing toward the Euphrates River. Concerned the Kurds will attempt to establish their own country from parts of Syria and Turkey, the Turkish government announced that it will attack the Kurdish army if it crosses the Euphrates River. Russia responded that it will fire on Turkish troops if they attack Kurdish forces and invade Syria. The U.S. has not publicly taken a stand on the issue, but in a rare example of coordination between adversaries, the Kurdish army is being supported by airstrikes from both the U.S. and Russia.
In London today, union leaders said a 48-hour strike will go into effect next weekend in tube stations around the city. The RMT union says it's striking over job cuts and closures of ticket offices within the system. The strike is set to start next Saturday night at 9 p.m. It's expected to severely clog services on Sunday and Monday of next week. Union leaders say the job losses are disproportionately in safety operations and that the cuts will impact ridership. Union leaders say they're planning 7 days of actions, including a ban on overtime hours for workers.
The World Health Organization today declared that the Zika virus constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. The emergency declaration allows the WHO to coordinate surveillance efforts internationally. It also serves to make nations aware that the disease is a serious concern. The WHO stressed that there is no need for travel or trade restrictions as of yet. They also repeated their warnings to pregnant women to wear appropriate clothing, use insect repellent, and take other practical measures, such as sleeping under a bed net to avoid being bitten. This is only the fourth time in the WHO's history that they've issued such a declaration. The first was in 2009 in response to the H1N1 swine flu virus. The second was in 2014 in response to a resurgence in polio. The third international public health emergency was in response to the Ebola outbreak in Africa, also in 2014. The virus has spread to 24 nations and territories in the Americas, and there have been 3 cases reported in the state of Oregon.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, February 2nd, 2016. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian youth in northern West Bank and close central West Bank city of Ramallah. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Monday morning a young Palestinian man south of the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim, Palestinian medics said. The slain Palestinian was identified as Ahmed Touba, 19, from Kufr Jamal village south of Tul Karim. Israeli sources claimed that the young Palestinian crossed the wall into the illegal Israeli settlement of Sal'it, built on Palestinian lands near Tul Karim, and that the soldiers rushed to the scene and conducted searches. The soldiers then located the Palestinian teenager reportedly in the bushes and tried to approach him to arrest him, but he pulled a knife and the soldiers shot him dead, according to Israeli sources. His father said that Ahmed usually works in construction whenever he has the chance. Palestinian Red Crescent medics have transferred the body of the slain Palestinian to Thabit Thabit Governmental Hospital in Tul Karim. Elsewhere, the Israeli army kidnapped 17 Palestinians during invasions targeting West Bank communities on Monday at dawn and Sunday night. According to the Palestinian Political Prisoner Society, invasions were reported in Hebron, Bethlehem, Nablus, Jenin, Jerusalem and Ramallah cities. Also on Monday, the Israeli army continued to besiege the central West Bank city of Ramallah and did not allow residents in or out of the city. Ramallah city is surrounded by 3 Israeli military checkpoints located at all main entrances of the city. The closure started on Sunday afternoon, shortly after a Palestinian man was shot and killed at an Israeli military checkpoint at the northern entrance of Ramallah. The Palestinian man was killed after shooting and injuring 3 Israeli soldiers manning a checkpoint that is located near the illegal Israeli settlement of Beit Eil. The Palestinian man was later identified as Amjad Abu Omar, aged 34, from Jamua village near Nablus. Abu Omar is a PA security staff sergeant and is a father of 4. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 2nd, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmael, Ammi, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Martin Dodge, Paul Reich, Joanna Peterson, Don Zer, Mike Weiner, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Chris Andre and Jamie Partridge. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, Abe and Joe take stock of the Iowa caucuses. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Economics Dean Baker speaks on the TPP, a corporate deal. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, DeMay Roberts talks with playwright Mia Chung, whose play You For Me, For You opens this week at Portland Playhouse. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galvin interviews photographer Michael Primo about Water Warriors, which documents efforts by East Coast Canadians and Native Americans to block fossil fuel exploration and drilling on their lands. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support that keeps KBOO on the air. You can become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Stay tuned now for an interview with Lana Jack of Celilo Falls, speaking about her family's struggle for federal recognition of their tribal treaty rights. Good night, Joanna.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Lana Jack is one of the last 20 known Celilo Wyom people of the Columbia River's historic Celilo Falls. Jack's family has fought against federal efforts to take their land for generations, but that fight is far from over. Today, Jack is located in a legal battle with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to gain rightful control over her family's land and recognition for their tribal rights. Currently, the Bureau of Indian Affairs refuses to recognize the Celilo Wyom tribe, and Jack's family faces felony charges relating to their traditional salmon fishing operations. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with Jack last week about the case.
Well, that's quite a loaded question. Good afternoon. My name is Lana Jack. My Indian name is Khir Paul. It's the ever-present cooling mist at the falls. My Indian name comes from my great-grandmother, Minnie Wesley Shawaway. Her daughter was Irene Williams Bruno, whose daughter was Mary Cook Jack, who was my mother. And I come from a long line of women who have carried the torch through six relocation plans and have paid the price dearly in much loss, pain, and suffering, which has really trickled down into this generation. We think of Celilo and Wyomtima, which is our name, Wayamtama. And thinking of it in terms of, you talked of 10,000 years of occupation, and 10,000 years of occupation means we have suffered through some really heavy winters to maintain our existence through thousands of years to be upon our ancient land in relationship with the falls, the salmon, and our way of life. In 1957, my grandmother and great-grandmother stood beside Chief Tommy Thompson and his delegates, one of them being Abe Shaway, husband to Minnie Wesley Shaway, who was the interpreter in many cases, as he represented in this circle of leadership as they proceeded to plead Congress not to flood Salila Falls. The beginning of these talks really began in 33 after the building of the Bonneville Dam. But in 1946, there were certain things put in writing in acknowledging the original people. The Yakima, Umatilla, and Warm Springs are all descendant of, and many have taken on one federally recognized title or another. But the thing is that the individual Indians who the United States government deemed Salila Wild Indians, they coined this term over my grandmother, Irene Williams Bruno, when she in fact said, after they stereotypically marginalized her off to this place of uneducated, six family, alcoholic, this, that, and the other, they coined the term Salila Wild Indian. So I represent the legacy of being one of these Salila Wild Indians, right?
That's unspeakable.
And I didn't even know this myself, except I read it in